Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Angela Duckworth to the broadcast. Angela is the author of Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, a book that explains why talent is hardly a guarantor of success. Angela has found that grit, which she defines as a combination of passion and perseverance for a singularly important goal, is the hallmark of high achievers in every domain. She's also found scientific evidence that grit can grow. In our conversation, we cover the applicability of this topic to parents and business leaders alike. Angela is also the professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and the founder and scientific director of the Character Lab, a nonprofit organization in Philadelphia whose mission is to advance the science and practice of character development. Angela was a 2013 MacArthur Fellow and delivered a popular TED Talk on the subject of grit. She received her bachelor's degree in advanced studies or neurobiology from Harvard, received her master's degree in neuroscience from Oxford University, and received a PhD in psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. I recently caught up with Angela while she was in Washington, D.C. for a book event, and you'll hear some background noise in the lobby of the hotel at which she was staying. Our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed how recruiting can take into account potential measures of grit, and some examples of organizations that have shifted their culture to become more gritty. We also discussed the different traits of gritty people, how her background teaching middle school in New York City has influenced her thoughts on grit, the development of the hard thing rule, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Angela Duckworth, it's a pleasure to meet you. I was mentioning a moment ago that one of the things that I loved about your book was I found applications personally as I was sort of assessing, you know, going through your own tests for grits as to see how I stack up. And I found it as somebody who hires people, who leads people, and thinking about the assessment of those who might join my organization, who are already part of my organization. I thought of it from the lens of a parent and my own kids and sort of the lessons for them as well. I thought we'd begin, first of all, with just your definition of grit. How do you define grit?
I define grit as a combination of perseverance and passion for especially challenging long-term goals.
And how did you determine that this would be at least a significant portion of your life work?
You know, I think I would date back the earliest glimpse of that to my first year of graduate school when I knew that I wanted to understand the psychology of high achievers. I mean, I basically believed then, and I do now, that almost anything can be studied, almost anything can be reverse engineered. So if we could put these high achievers under the microscope, that we'd be able to emulate or imitate at least their habits, their beliefs, and maybe replicate their experiences. So I started interviewing these high achievers and in business, but also in sports. And it wasn't very systematic. I was like pretty much any high achiever that I could lay my hands on through connections of my advisor or myself. And these themes really emerged from the conversations. And those were two. One was, wow, the people who are really successful in my field are relentlessly dedicated to what they do. They have a kind of endurance. One, in their effort, right? They don't get disappointed for long. It's not that they don't get disappointed, but they get back up again and they're tirelessly working to get better. So perseverance, but also a kind of stamina in their interest. I mean, they're just never bored of what they do and they find it infinitely meaningful. And so they don't switch course a lot. They don't work hard at different things. They work hard at one thing.
And one of the things I thought was very interesting, we're speaking now in commencement season.
And it seems like every commencement address, as you mentioned, has the sort of follow your passion, as though the passion's half a block ahead of you. And you make the point that in some ways that's not necessarily the most productive way to think about this. And you talk about the essential element of trying a variety of things and quitting those things that are not going to spark kind of a passion inside of you until you find that one thing or series of things that are going to help you kind of down that path towards grit. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the challenges of commencement speeches is that you have this older, wiser person who's very accomplished talking to young, not yet so wise, not yet accomplished adults, or in high school or middle school, even younger. And there is a bit of a mismatch because the commencement speaker probably has found their passion and is pursuing it with verve every day. But when you're 18 or when you're 22 and you have no idea what you want to do with your life, I think it can be terrifying. So here's what the paragons of grit who are often like at the commencement podium, I think may say, but I would certainly say, I have to give one myself to a little school in the West Philadelphia neighborhood called Boys Latin. It's a 100% free and reduced price lunch school. And they're like, could you come be your graduation speaker? And I was like, I'd totally be your graduation speaker. So here's what I'm going to say. You know, I think it's really important to realize that the process of fostering a passion, and that's the verb I prefer, like fostering one, because it's an active, lengthy process, not a instant, passive discovery process. It really takes trial and error. It takes experience. You can't do it all in your head. And it takes a long time. You know, for graduates that are in the worst position, let me put it this way. There are a lot of young people who manage to spend their 4 years at Penn or elsewhere, their 4 years in college or their 4 years in high school, worried that they won't know what they want to do when they get out, but not actually experimenting. And I think one of the things about interest development is that you can't predict from your own thoughts and your imagination what you'll like and what you don't like. And you can't get really into something until you actually do exactly that. I mean, you have to sign up for it and you have to like go to practices and you have to like talk to other people on your team and then start reading blog posts. And it's really a process rather than a discovery.
Got it. And you talk about how you've developed the hard thing rule for your family. I wonder if you could kind of dial through, you had the three levels of the hard thing rule, which I think is applicable to what you're just describing here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was kind of growing up at Penn, where I did my PhD, both as a mom and as a psychologist at the same exact time, because I had my second daughter. I was pregnant with one daughter, and I had just had the first when I was in the first year of graduate school. And so I was thinking to myself every day when I would come home, you know, what are the implications of what I'm studying for my own children? And my husband and I developed this hard thing rule to basically, one, help our kids develop habits that they wouldn't develop on their own. The first thing is to actually do a hard thing, which is to, this is the first part of the rule, and this is the reason why we put it in there. We didn't think our kids would do it on their own, that they would have to pursue something that required truly deliberate practice, which is the term that psychologists use for the effortful, at the edge of your ability practice that really makes you better. We knew that at age 5, which is when we started using the hard thing rule, that our little kindergarten children like would not be able to do more than maybe a minute of deliberate practice. But we wanted them to have a taste of what it was like to work on something challenging with concentration and feedback and then try it all over again and get better. The second part of the hard thing rule is that they weren't allowed to quit what they were doing until a natural stopping point. You know, we really felt like with our kids that on their own, they wouldn't learn to fulfill their commitments and to sort of see things through to the end. So often they would ask us to quit things because, you know, the track meet didn't go very well. They didn't like coming in last place. You know, they didn't like the way their teacher talked to them. They didn't like that they had to put their hair in a bun for ballet. I mean, you know, a million things. I mean, they're kids, right? And we said to them that we understood how they felt, but that they needed to finish what they began. And when the tuition payment was up or the season was over, they could switch to a new hard thing, but not until then. And then the last thing, and I think this is very important because, you know, there's a kind of knee-jerk reflex among some parents that, you know, just more discipline and more effort is the only thing that kids need. But I think they also need choice, and they need us to, like, respect their perspective. So the third part of the hard thing rule is that nobody gets to choose your hard thing but you. And even when our kids were very young, 5 years old, we let them choose. I mean, it was multiple choice, not fill in the blank, but it was like, do you want to go to gymnastics, which is 5 blocks from our house, or you can go to ballet school, and that's across the street, or grandma has an old piano, you know, we can find someone to give you a piano lesson. So they had limited choice, but they were able to choose. And I think that, you know, if you are a young person, you know, wanting to develop a passion, you know, you can't expect anyone else to tell you what that passion would be.
And I like the way you framed it. You said that school is often hard and not interesting to a child. Texting is very interesting, but not very hard. And so finding the third thing that is a combination of those things, something that will require some work and stick-to-itiveness and perseverance, but something that is not, by definition, not something that's intrinsically easy, but something that actually hopefully that you'll develop an interest in as well. So some sort of, as you've begun to mention, extracurricular outside of the school settings, whether it's ballet or a sport or an instrument. So finding these sorts of things to be able to be, you know, that hard thing that they're going to pursue.
Yeah, I think of a lot of adults think back about, you know, where their interests evolved and where they learned lessons about being disciplined, practicing, getting up again, being resilient. I think a lot of us will remember that through our sports or through our, you know, writing for the school newspaper. For me, I did a lot of community service in high school and college, and those lessons were at least as important as what as I learned in the classroom. I think actually at one point at Harvard, I was easily spending more time in community service than I was in the lecture halls and in the laboratories. And you know, one of the great tragedies, I think, of American education is that extracurricular activities are becoming marginalized. You know, like we care so much about our kids' test scores, and we think that, you know, we have to maximize the amount of time that they are drilled for one end of the year test. And it's, I think, really important that kids have these other ways to not only express their grit, but develop their grit.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about four different traits of gritty people: interest, practice, purpose, and hope. And you've alluded to several of these. You intend for those to happen in that order. We've talked about interest. You've mentioned how it's like human nature to seek the novel. And,
yes.
And a nuance I really like that you've talked about is you need to learn to substitute nuance for novelty. So in the things that you are choosing, find, strive for the thing that will make it interesting again or make it new again for you. I wonder if we can go sort of dial through the four different traits.
So then briefly, since we did touch on interest, I mean, I think that substituting nuance for novelty really is what experts do, and that's why they're never bored. And I never tire myself of observing experts. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, I took a pasta making class with Mark Vetri, who's one of the masters. He's a chef in Philadelphia, my favorite chef, very gritty. And he was making the dough, and he was milling the flour in front of us, and you know, he could feel it, and he was like, just a little bit more. I mean, none of us who were watching him make it had any idea the difference between one bowl of flour or the next, but he was feeling it with his fingers, and then he was running it through the mixer, and then, you know, feeling it again, and then putting just a drop of water in, and then feeling it again. That's what experts do. They are sensitive to these nuances, and I do think there's a special pleasure in that, which is different from the kind of cheap thrill that we all get from watching like a cat video or like a, you know, stupid stunt that someone sends us the YouTube video for. So the second thing is that having developed interest, and it does take actually a period of years for many people, right? So they can often remember a singular experience, like the time that I saw the red shoes and wanted to be a ballerina. But that experience is invariably followed up by multiple other experiences. Otherwise, that little flicker sort of dies out. So after you've gotten into something, right, in a usually kind of fun way, not necessarily a super disciplined way, there is a second stage where you learn to practice and you learn to improve in your skill through this deliberate practice that I mentioned. And it really is incredibly straightforward. And when I say these four things, you might think like, well, why isn't everybody doing deliberate practice all the time? One is you have to be working on something you can't yet do, some like narrow aspect of your performance. Second, you have to concentrate and try hard. Third, you need feedback to know what you did right, what could be better. And fourth, you need to reflect, make a refinement, and then repeat from the beginning, which is to try to do something you can't yet do. So why aren't we all doing it all the time? I think that if you put these things all together, you get an experience which for most people, not all, is not fun. I mean, I just asked my daughter, Lucy, I tried to do this like viral thing called Month of Grit. How much do you practice? And she practices viola. And she's like, I practice about an hour a day. And I say, is it deliberate practice? And she said, well, sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why isn't it deliberate practice all the time? And she said, because it's hard and there are always easier things to do. So that's what that period, that sort of second period. Now, by the way, interest never ends and practice never ends, but you're sort of layering on. So now in the third stage, you are interested and you've learned how to practice and you're still practicing and you're still interested. But now there's a third sort of stage of evolution. And that is to develop a sense of meaning or purpose in your work. And I've never interviewed an adult paragon of grit who didn't have a sense that their work was not just interesting, but important and important to other people. You know, no journalist that I've ever met, no chef that I've ever met, no athlete that I've ever met, they really understand that their work is connected to other people. I think that's a fundamental human motive. So that's partly why you find it in grit paragons. If they only were interested, it would be like having one engine on out of two, right? When they both have interest and purpose, wow, now I really want to get up in the morning and I want to do this. And then the fourth thing that I mentioned in the book, which is not really a stage because you need it all along, really, is that you have to maintain a sense of hope. And I think when you ask the question, like, why do people give up on things? Sometimes they lose interest. Sometimes they haven't developed a habit of practicing and they don't have the capacity for that. Sometimes they don't see the greater purpose. But I think most often they lose hope. They feel like they can't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I would be a journalist, but I don't think I can. I would be a psychologist, but I don't think I can. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot to say about that. But I think the most important thing to say about hope is that the kind of hope that I'm talking about is believing that there's something, even a little thing, that you can do to change your future. Doesn't mean that you think it'll be sunny today in Washington, D.C. It doesn't mean that you think everything's going to be perfect. It doesn't mean that you think that there's no such thing as luck. But it means that you believe that there's something, even a little thing, that you can do to change your future.
You, after undergrad, taught 7th grade math in New York City. And I have to imagine, I believe you even tell about stories about the differences from a hope perspective or an optimism. You know, I think there are some people who have good reason, perhaps, to think they are structurally held down. And there's some sort of force that is beyond their ability to overcome that is going to keep them from doing things or reach their dreams. Do you have sort of insights into how to turn that a little bit or to?
I mean, it's really important for me to try to explain, although I do think it's difficult. I haven't been successful so far, that when you think about an individual and their character, you know, this person's really gritty. This person's optimistic. This person's kind. This person's honest. You know, we, of course, always think about the person versus the situation, right? Oh, well, you know, they stole because of this situation, not because of who they are. But it's much more complicated than that. If you ask the question, where did the grit come from, or where did the honesty come from? Like, it came from a lifetime of experiences. I mean, the situation and the individual are braided together, right? So, for example, when you have kids who give up easily and are frustrated and then don't try, well, I always ask the question, what made them that way? And I think that if you're a kid who grows up with no role models for grit or other character strengths, and you don't have support and challenge, the kind of magic combination that seems to encourage things like grit, then it's not necessarily that I have to say, well, you are gritty, but you're... And it's just the plain reality that this kid could have been more gritty if their situation had been different. I think at the end of the day, kids, like all individuals, are actually very rational. I know that that's not a very popular view because we like to think about human beings as being irrational. You know, it's like, oh, what about all these studies that show that people are rational? But I mean, I will submit this. You know, kids are sane. You know, they don't do things that they think aren't going to work out. They don't do things that they think are going to hurt themselves. They do things that make sense to them at the moment. And for kids who are growing up with a lot of disadvantage, I think they haven't had the life experiences in many cases that would encourage the kind of skills, the habits, and the beliefs that are adaptive. That's really where I want to, I mean, I'm thinking like I'll probably die within 40 years or 50 years, maybe within 4 or 5. Like, if there's one last thing that I'm going to do on the planet, is going to like do as much as I can to figure out how can we give kids the experiences that would bring them closer to, you know, a life that would be good for them and good for other people.
That's great. I want to talk about the implications for organizations, for businesses. You have a lot of really interesting vignettes, for instance, about Pete Carroll and the culture that he has built. Yeah. It's really interesting stories that you tell there. And you talk about the formation of gritty culture. For somebody who aspires to that, to build one where it isn't already, what are some of the things that, in terms of the words to use, in terms mm-hmm. of the actions to exemplify, what have you seen mm-hmm. in organizations that have gone from non-gritty to gritty in formulating that cultural?
Yeah, no, super great questions. One thing I'll say is that psychologists study the individual, but if you're a very good psychologist, eventually you start trying to understand culture because you can't understand the individual separate from the culture in which they exist. And we are deeply cultural animals. You know, you walk into this hotel and you immediately sense, like, how do people talk here? You start to adjust your tone of voice. One sociologist that I include in the book recently came to Penn to give a talk, Dan Chambliss. He said, if you want to learn French, you can buy a book. Probably won't learn French. If you want to learn French, you could take Berlitz lessons. Probably won't work. If you want to learn French, you could take a class at a community college. Might work. If you want to learn French, you could get a French tutor. Okay, now you're getting somewhere. He's like, you want to know how to learn French? Be born in France. And so, you know, the point being that, you know, when you grow up and everybody's doing something, you do it, right? I mean, all those kids in France are, they speak beautifully, no matter what they're, you don't have to know anything else about them. So I think that people are deeply cultural. Here's what I think about gritty cultures. I've always found that they have a really gritty leader. I mean, a very high profile, gritty leader. And I think that is because people emulate the person at the top, right? They set the tone. It doesn't mean that that's enough, but I think that's a start. The second thing is that, you know, that gritty leader can do things like share with the people who are not yet at that position what it really took to get there. They can demystify high performance. For example, you know, there's this Princeton professor who posted his CV with all the failures on it, right? So not just all the highlights, but all the, like, you know, papers rejected. And I loved that, and I tweeted it out because in my own lab, as an academic, I get, I guess, more than 50% of my, well over 50% of my papers are flat out rejected. And not just rejected, but, like, really nastily rejected with these, like, long single-spaced letters about, like, how truly awful, uninformative, poorly written, poorly argued, you know, this paper was. And when I'm the first author, meaning that it's really my work, and it's very personal, right? It's hard to not take these attacks as ad hominem. Mm-hmm. I immediately forward the rejection letter to everybody in my lab so they can see everything. So they can see that eventually this paper will get published, but they can see that it's flawed, that other people see its flaws. And when I was leaving on book tour, I sent an apology to my lab. First, I apologized for not being a great leader this year. I wasn't around. I was, like, holed up in my bedroom in my pajamas, like, trying to write this book. And, you know, I didn't come in enough. And I apologized for that. And then I said, I also want you to know that there were so many times during this journey where I, the person who studies grit, I almost gave up. I mean, I told my daughters and my husband that I couldn't do it. I almost threw my laptop into the Atlantic Ocean at one point. My husband had to restrain me. And I was so frustrated and so disappointed in myself. And I couldn't even see around the corner to know that it would be better. And then I said, and I cried a lot. I think that one thing that gritty leaders can do is to not only show strength, but also be honest about weakness, because if you really want people to come after you and, you know, walk that hard path, they should know that it's a hard path and not a smooth one. So that's one thing. Third one is, you know, they are all storytellers. I mean, especially in a reasonably large organization, these leaders like Jamie Dimon, like Pete Carroll, they're all telling stories over and over and over again. Tori Burch, who's another paragon of grit who I didn't put in the book, and she said, like, you just have to get up every day and, like, you know, begin again with motivating your team, setting the culture. It's work that's never done. And so stories that continually motivate people, that keep them focused. And also, I will say this, and this is a bit speculative, but I really think it's true. You know, people who are in a great organization have a sense of the history and the future of the organization. That's part of purpose, is to feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. It's no surprise that at West Point, they say that you're part of the long gray line, right? And that you're not only the end, you're just in the middle. And then there's going to be, you know, cadets who come after you. And it's true about our own country, right? You know, like, why do we still talk about, like, Alexander Hamilton and the founding fathers? It's because we all have a craving to know that this is part of something larger than ourselves. So there's storytelling in the kind of small lowercase s way, but there's also sort of, like, uppercase S, where you're like, this is our history, this is who we are. There's language. I think gritty leaders are very intentional about their language. They want to make sure that the people who are in that organization have the same vocabulary. So it's not that different from like when you're in France, you speak French, and when you're in Spain, you speak Spanish. So when I was at the Seahawks, the coaches said, I speak fluent Carol. And I was like, oh my God, this is a culture, right? Yeah. They're doing it. So anyway, so those are some of the things. And then finally, I'll just say there are rituals that I think, you know, are not trivial. So sometimes I'll go and give a talk at a company and, you know, everyone's wearing their colors, right? Because the company has colors and they have these rituals like, oh, you know, what we do here, the way we begin breakfast is with like kudos. And we start off with like, whatever it is, those rituals, I think, become, you know, they reinforce your identity. And there are ways of sort of ritualizing grit. I mean, in the case of the Seahawks, where, you know, nobody likes to look at their mistakes. Nobody likes to do deliberate practice and get feedback on what they did wrong. But Pete Carroll has ritualized it. You know, it's Tell the Truth Monday. Everybody looks at their film. Everybody looks at what they did right. It's just normal. Yeah. So anyway, so those are a few things. But I will end on this. As Pete Carroll told me, it is not one thing. It is a million things.
Likewise, when one is recruiting, how then do you factor grit in? I mean, you've got a test that you provide.
So the first thing I tell people is don't use my test. Right, right. Okay. Yeah, right? Because it's so dumb. what's the second thing I say?
Yeah. What
right,
replaces
yeah.
it?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I'll tell you what, like an idea that I have data on, and I'll tell you my favorite idea that I don't have data on. My idea that I have data on is you can't actually analyze a resume for grit. I mean, you can look for evidence that somebody has sustained effort and interest in something over years. I mean, it's really that simple. So if you have a 22-year-old, you can ask, like, how did they spend their 4 years between 18 and 22? What is the evidence they've done something for more than a year or two and actually made progress? It can be in sports, and it's sort of easy to see, right? You know, like, I have tremendous respect of one of the young women who works in my lab. She was a 4-year swimmer. If you're 4 years of swimming at Princeton, like, that's a hell of a lot of deliberate practice, a hell of a lot of failure and coming back from failure. That is sustained interest. That is somebody who must see the greater purpose of what they're doing. Great. But it's not just sports. I mean, it could be the Daily Pennsylvanian, or it could be, you know, for a lot of kids who don't have money, it can be their work. I mean, they have to work to make money. So, but are they doing well? You know, are they getting better shift? Are they, you know, employee of the month? So that's the best thing that I can say that I have data on. Because I have these longitudinal data sets where I can say, look, just coding from the resume, you can predict grit and predict the same outcomes that you predict with the scale. But here's my idea that I don't have any data on, which is that if grit really is sticking with things over the long term and trying to get better at it and maintaining focus, we should try to give people a task that requires exactly that. So if you have a training program to onboard people, or to, you know, that you know that there's a skill set that they're going to have to learn, why don't you give it to the applicants and see, you know, who asks for feedback? You know, I'll give you one really specific example, but I don't think it's ever been done. So at Teach for America, you have to do a practice lesson. You have to like get up and pretend that you're teaching a little lesson. I think it's a great idea. But I've always wanted to know, who are the teachers who would say, can I see that video of my lesson? And by the way, there were 4 people rating me. Could I see what they said? And can I teach that lesson again? Give me another try. And then again and then again. And I guarantee you that, you know, the best teachers would end up being the ones who come back over and over again wanting to know how they could get better.
You also, in addition to being a professor at Penn, run the Character Lab in Philadelphia. Can you talk a bit about the mission of that and how you spend your time on it?
So about 3 years ago, I founded this nonprofit with 2 educators. We had already been working together trying to figure out, you know, where character development might grow at the intersection of science and educational practice, right? And so we had a lot of success ourselves in figuring out things that neither the educators nor I would have been able to figure out on our own. And then we thought, well, we need to scale this. Like, other people need to do this. So we started the Character Lab so that we could explore things, not just grit, which I already study, not just self-control, which I already study, but things that I don't study and I'm not an expert in, like gratitude, emotional intelligence, curiosity, imagination, and so on. So that was 3 years ago. What happened while I was writing the book is that we decided that really for this organization to reach its vision, its potential, that we would move it to the campus of, you know, from Midtown Manhattan to the campus of University of Pennsylvania, so that we would have one roof under which everyone, including me, would be working. So I did that in the middle of writing this book, and I became the scientific director. And I will say this, when I made that decision, it's a little bit like, I don't know if you know the Rudyard Kipling poem, If. And the second to last stanza, it's like, if you can put, you know, all of your winnings in one heap and wage it all on one turn of pitch and toss and lose it and start all over again with worn out tools, like, could be getting, I'm trying to memorize that poem. I've got a little bit wrong, but like, I was like, basically that's what I did. I was like, you know what? I'm a pretty successful professor and I'm reasonably respected. I know how to do this game, but I'm like, I am going to put everything I have, like for the rest of my life, on this one bet, which is that if scientists and educators worked meaningfully together, that we would be able to radically advance our understanding of character development in ways that have never been done or seen before. So that's what I'm doing with the character lab.
Yeah, exactly. You're, as though you're not busy enough.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I actually did try to postpone it till after the book, but my board insisted, and I think they were right, but like, yeah, it was a very busy year.
It reminds me, I mean, you have so many great quotes in the book from others, like Theodore Roosevelt's quote, which I will not attempt.
I'm trying to memorize that one too.
Yeah,
right?
I'd like
yeah.
to. And the other one that I like, which I think is like a theme from across our conversation, was Henry Ford, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
And I was very careful. You'll appreciate this as a journalist, because I tried to verify everything in this book. I mean, I fact checked this book, like, you know, I sent the behavioral genetics part to like the leading behavioral geneticist. And, you know, I was like, just wanted to make sure it was completely accurate. And when I researched that quote, you know, Henry Ford is quoted as saying that out the wazoo. I wasn't able to find where he actually wrote it.
Oh.
So he may have said it. And
I
then
see.
Yeah. But anyway, he certainly quoted as saying, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. And I think it's deeply wise. I hope he said it.
Yeah.
Somebody said it.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody said
it. It's out there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. Angela Duckworth, thank you so much for taking time and talking a bit about the Lessons from Grit. It was a really fantastic book. Congratulations on your accomplishment.
I appreciate it.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.